Production support for Earth Eats comes from Elizabeth Rue, enrolled agent with Personal Financial Services, assisting businesses and individuals with tax preparation and planning for over 15 years. More at personalfinancialservices.net. And The Clean Bedroom, offering organic mattresses, adjustable beds, and pillows, helping mindful customers create a sustainable and organic clean bedroom step by step. New York City, Boston, and now Indianapolis. More at thecleanbedroom.com. Welcome to Earth Eats. I'm your host, Kate Young. On today's show, we explore research on food pairing and flavor networks. Earth Eats associate producer Alex Chambers walks us through the work of Dr. Yongyeol Ahn. He goes by YY. Dr. Ahn is a professor of informatics and computing at Indiana University and co-creator of a fascinating map of flavor networks. Harvest Public Media has a story about some special Midwestern grapes, and Chef Daniel Orr has ideas for grape leaves, plus a surprising preparation involving rhubarb and strawberries. It's not what you think. Stay with us to find out. The world's global wine production is as low as it's been in six decades. But in the United States, wine output is as healthy as ever. Midwestern grapes once helped save the European wine industry, and as Laura Ziegler reports for Harvest Public Media, a vineyard outside of Weston, Missouri is trying to find and preserve those grapes.
The only way to start a story about wine is with a tasting, right?
I've always wanted to see a radio wine tasting, so...
That's Jerry Eisterhold pouring wine in the tasting room of Vox Vineyard, where for the last 20-some years, he's been experimenting with grapes no one has been making wine from for a century and a half. Eisterhold grew up near Hermann, Missouri, dubbed the Rhineland, because of the influence of German immigrants. He's been interested in wine ever since.
So which is this now?
This is a grape called Wetumpka.
Wetumpka.
Yes.
Eisterhold says the Wetumpka grape can be hard to deal with. It immediately drops to the ground when it's ripe. The grapes, when pressed, are mostly pulp. In spite of these challenges, Eisterhold gets a kick out of making wine no one's ever tasted. Wine expert Doug Frost joins us for the tasting. He swirls his glass and buries his nose in it before taking a sip.
Tropical fruit for me, kind of, sort of a pineapple thing.
Frost says the best wines say something about the soil, the climate, even the culture of where grapes are grown.
So that when you taste a wine, you actually can say to yourself, you know, I can't taste this any place except there's this one place north of Kansas City that has this grape growing there, and it tastes just like this one. That uniqueness is what you hope for.
And that's just what Eisterhold is going for. A rare book collector, he pulls a worn volume from his shelf. It's The Foundations of American Grape Culture by 19th century horticulturalist Thomas Volney Munson. The book is Munson's account of his work with indigenous American grapes. The Illinois-born botanist realized Midwestern varieties were hardier than cultured varieties. He spent his life collecting those grapes throughout the Midwest, Nebraska, Missouri, and North Texas, where he settled. His research was internationally recognized. When a deadly aphid began to decimate European vineyards, growers asked Munson to send them some of his pest-resistant rootstock. It saved the European wine industry. Eisterhold has found Munson's abandoned vineyards in Texas. He's tagged pages of Munson's book with illustrations of vines he wants cuttings of. It's a slow business.
You get half of them, and then you try to root them, and then you half of them root, and... So it has taken about 15 years to simply get a row of 12 plants of each of these, the vines that I have out there.
Once the vines bear fruit, every iteration of wine takes a whole year to turn around. But Clark Smith, who Eisterhold has brought on as a consultant, says some of these grapes are really good and important to preserve.
I mean, imagine if nobody knew about Mozart, and then all of a sudden somebody dug up his work and said, well, you know, this guy wrote some pretty good stuff. It's like that.
The sliding glass doors from Eisterhold's tasting room give way to a balcony overlooking 6 rolling acres of still naked vines. Below us, a worker is shoveling soil from the concrete patio into beds where cuttings for next year's crop will start. Eisterhold has labeled his wine Terra Vox, or Voice of the Land. He believes it captures the essence of Munson's work.
He was a little bit of a philosopher and a little, you know, he had the idea that agriculture and the plants and animals that we deal with are not fixed things, that they needed to evolve. So all of this is trying to sort of pick up on the wave that he started.
And show people Missouri wine can rival any in the world. For Harvest Public Media, I'm Laura Ziegler.
Harvest Public Media covers our food system from the heartland, and you can find more at harvestpublicmedia.org. Speaking of Midwest wines, if you happen to live near a winery or know where some wild grapes are growing, consider preserving the leaves. Grape leaves are used in dishes such as dolmas, and Chef Daniel Orr is going to tell us how to process them at home.
We get a lot of goodies this time of year that are only really available this time of year, and one of them is grape leaves. Fresh grape leaves you really need to pick when they're young, still tender, nice and green, very vibrant colored, and you want to get nice big ones because you're going to be stuffing them. You can use any kind of grape leaves. Wild grape leaves tend to be a little smaller, but you can use them. And if you use those, a lot of times I'll do is I'll take 2 or 3 of those leaves to roll one dolma because they are smaller. You wash them well, and then you blanch them and shock them. Again, blanching is cooking them quickly in heavily salted water. Shocking is dropping them in an ice water bath. Then we're going to lay them out, and we're going to stack them. And there are lots of different things you can do with these. And stuff them with a hot stuffing, such as a kind of a sausage and rice stuffing. Then roll them up and then bake them in a sauce. You can fill them with rice and then steam them and serve them cold. I also like to fill them with risotto and mozzarella cheese and then bake them in a tomato sauce. So lots of different things you can do. You can even wrap them around fish like a salmon or even fresh sardines and then put them on the grill. You need to have about 40 or 50 of these to fill a jar. And once you have them stacked, you're gonna fold them up. Now they're still really tough at this point, so they wouldn't really be that enjoyable to eat. So the canning process is one of the things that makes them palatable. What you do is you fold these up from the sides, almost like you're making a burrito, and you make little packages like that, and then you put them in your canning jars, then you fill it up with water that's salted to the point it'd be almost like ocean water, and then you're going to put a fair amount of lemon juice. You need 1/4 cup of lemon juice or 1/2 teaspoon of citric acid per jar, and that is what's going to really make them tender and also give them a lot of flavor.
Find this recipe and instructions for canning your grape leaves at eartheats.org.
Hey, Kate.
Hey, Alex.
So I've got a story for you. It's about food and flavors and how to put those together.
So food pairings?
Yeah. And it's also about data, how we collect data about what we like to eat. It's kind of a cautionary tale.
So you're saying it's a food pairing parable?
You could say that. It starts with an image.
Let's have it.
So I've got this graphic in front of me, and it looks a little like the map of your airline's flight routes in the back of the in-flight magazine. But instead of the big hubs being Atlanta and Chicago, they're roast beef, black tea, and beer. And there's no Pacific Northwest or Florida. Instead of regions of the country, there are fruits, vegetables, alcoholic beverages, spices, meats. It's kind of beautiful. Each category of food has a different color. And there are these circles of different sizes that show how popular each ingredient is. And they're connected by lines of different thicknesses. Those lines are the key, what the graphic is about. But before I get to that, I want to say that the researchers who created this graphic used it to give us new insights into how global cuisines relate to each other and don't relate. insights that have been written up in the Washington Post and Scientific American and even NPR, and which may not be accurate at all. So how did all this get started?
I was just sitting in the same office with one of my colleagues, and he's really interested in food.
This is YY An, one of the researchers.
I'm an assistant professor at Department of Informatics.
At Indiana University. He spoke with Earth Eats producers Lee Bush.
I'm Lee.
And Maddie Chara.
And I'm Maddie.
Last December. So, his office mate
went to some seminar by colleagues, a physicist colleague. And this colleague studies like food science in a like physics way.
And he comes back to the office after this seminar and starts telling YY about the food pairing hypothesis.
The idea is basically, okay, if you have two food ingredients that share some flavor compounds, if you mix them, they'll taste better.
The idea has gotten a lot of traction lately. Chefs are using it to come up with new dishes, and there's even a website, foodpairing.com, where if you subscribe, you can use their scientific method to identify which foods and drinks go well together.
My friend, my office mate, when he heard about that idea, he immediately realized that it's about networks, because you're talking about ingredients, sharing compounds, So you're making connections between ingredients. So that's essentially network.
Whoa. So that's how your flavor network project was born,
yeah,
basically?
Yeah. So right after the seminar, he apparently rushed to the library, sit there for a week, typed a whole book that lists like flavor compound and ingredients.
And that's what the graphic is all about. Each of the ingredients is represented by a circle. The size of the circle shows how common the ingredient is. Ingredients are linked up with other ingredients by lines of different thicknesses that show how many flavor compounds those ingredients share. You might not be surprised that beef and pork share a lot of flavor compounds. But it's interesting to note that garlic, which is super popular, hardly shares flavors with any other ingredients, whereas beer, while not popular as an ingredient, seems to be at the center of everything flavor-wise. Anyway, YY and Sebastian didn't want to just stop at this beautiful rendition of the flavor network. They wanted to test the flavor pairing hypothesis itself. Do dishes taste better when their ingredients share flavor compounds?
People made these nice dishes and nice combinations, new combinations of food using this food pairing hypothesis. But nobody really kind of systematically studied that.
To answer, you need to know what people actually cook.
I was kind of chatting in the office, and I thought that maybe we can use recipes to kind of test the hypothesis.
And even though immediately after Sebastian heard about the flavor hypothesis,
he apparently rushed to the library, typed a whole book.
It's not like they were going to type out thousands of cookbooks worth of recipes. They got their data the way most of us do when we need to look something up. They went online.
We used two recipe databases, which are kind of in English and fairly large. These are epicurious.com and
one of my favorites.
Yeah,
allrecipes.com. But then these are all American websites. Mm-hmm. So I chose one Korean recipe website called menupan.com.
And how many recipes did that end up being?
It's about 56,000 recipes total.
And they grouped the recipes into geographically distinct cuisines. North American, Western European, Southern European, Latin American, and East Asian, based on how they were tagged on the website.
So what were some of the things that came out of this project? What did you find?
Well, I think the most interesting thing was there's a huge variance across culture. So I mean, the initial idea was, can we test this hypothesis of food pairing, right? Mm-hmm.
That flavor compounds
make
ingredient combinations that will appear more frequently in recipes because they share similar flavors.
Right. So they crunched some numbers.
Wow, Alex, is that actually the sound of numbers being crunched?
No, that's chips. I figure they've got a munch on something while they do their math.
Oh. Well, what did they find?
Did the theory hold?
It seems to hold in North American and Western European recipes.
Interesting.
But
get ready for
it. The opposite holds for like East Asian recipes.
In other words, in North American and Western European recipes, the more flavor compounds are shared by two ingredients, the more likely they appear together in recipes. But in East Asian cuisine, the more flavor compounds two ingredients share, the less likely they're used together. This is the part where I started to get excited. Data science was revealing something about cultural practice that we hadn't been able to see because it needed to be quantified first. And I'm not the only one who found this exciting. This is the result that made its way into the magazines and newspapers, including the MIT Technology Review, which says that these recipe networks give the lie to the idea that ingredients that share flavors taste better together. But do they? It turns out, after all that fanfare, that's not quite what the report says. I'll explain after the break.
Production support comes from Charles Schwab & Company, Incorporated, with a local branch on Morton Street in Bloomington. Independent branch leader Jeremy Zeigner, CFP, offers personalized financial plans matched to investors' goals. More at schwab.com/Bloomington. Need more coffee roasters? A woman-owned coffee bar and roastery dedicated to roasting organic, direct trade, and fair trade coffee from small-scale farmers around the world. Offering signature drinks, teas, and little eats. Located on Pete Ellis Drive. Needmoreroasters.com. And Elizabeth Rue, enrolled agent with Personal Financial Services, assisting businesses and individuals with tax preparation and planning for over 15 years. More at personalfinancialservices.net.
So we left off with the conclusion that different cuisines approach taste in really different ways. Some like to overlap and blend flavors, while others like to contrast them. If you care about making things taste good, this is worth knowing. But if you're really curious, you start to look at what the ingredients are, and things suddenly get a lot murkier. The thing is, these conclusions are based on the prevalence of six characteristic ingredients in each of the cuisines. In East Asian, it's soy sauce, scallion, sesame oil, rice, ginger, and soybean. Not too surprising, right? Now listen to the six most authentic North American ingredients. Butter. Egg. Wheat. Milk. Vanilla. Cane molasses. Think about that North American list. Of all the possibilities, doesn't it seem strange that vanilla is in the top six? What do you use vanilla for? Especially in combination with eggs, flour, milk, and something called cane molasses. Baked goods. Dessert. And dessert got me thinking about data. The data that YY and Sebastian used suggests that baked goods are the most popular part of the North American diet, the thing North Americans eat more than anything else. But as much as we like our cakes, that kind of didn't seem right. So I asked Mehdi Chara, one of the food anthropologists who interviewed YY, why there might be so many recipes for baked goods. She said the websites don't necessarily reflect what we actually cook.
I know I don't bake cakes, you know, even once a month, as much as I enjoy cakes. However, I think that when I do bake a cake, partially because baking is so precise, I usually tend to use a recipe. And I think also that there's a bit of entertainment value in recipes for things like baked goods and desserts. So it's maybe not as fun to read about. I think I was thinking of vegan nut loaf, which would be a pretty complex thing to make and not many people know about it. But probably you're only looking up a recipe for that if you're actually going to make it.
Whereas
people enjoy reading or looking at recipes for sort of fun celebratory foods like cakes, cookies, other desserts, even if they're not going to actually make them. So there might be more of those recipes out there, and it's not necessarily a reflection of how frequently they're consumed in the diet.
And if the websites don't reflect what we eat, then YY's datasets might not be saying what we think they're saying and what we want them to be saying, like that these two cuisines are different. One matches flavors and one contrasts them. The data might not be telling us that, which was a bummer because I liked the idea that East Asian cuisine was doing something different with flavor than North American. But if the proof wasn't in the online pudding recipe, maybe I could find someone who'd tasted the pudding. Luckily, I had a food anthropologist on hand.
I think that even if the data is imperfect, there might be some truth there based on my ethnographic experience, which was in southern India. And from what I know from reading and observing and talking to people there, there is a high value placed on having lots of different contrasting flavors within a meal and even within a dish.
Which, in southern India at least, has to do with the influence of the Ayurvedic tradition, where there are six different flavors and
those present in the dish or the meal creates a sense of balance.
There's a reason YY's point about cuisines was so exciting. It felt right. And Maddie Chara's on-the-ground research says it might hold water after all. Trying to figure this story out reminded me that the information we collect about people is never neutral. It's always from a perspective, and it doesn't necessarily reflect what people are actually doing, because it doesn't capture everything about their lives. Which is why, if you're into crunching numbers, it can be good to have an anthropologist around.
Just talking to people, getting life histories, interviewing them, spending a lot of time with a certain cultural community and really learning more about their daily practices and what kind of flavors they put together.
To help figure out how people might be making the data and using it in their daily lives. To check your bird's eye view. For YY, though, I might be missing the point. The goal of the study wasn't to prove something beyond a doubt. We would need a better understanding of people's actual practices to do that.
Yeah, so I think the important meaning of this research is we have data, and we can use data sets to study like cuisines and food culture. And I think that's a big milestone that we can pass. So it's not like really, how to say, showing like really strong result. It's more like, oh, maybe this is possible. And why don't you come over and have fun and enjoy looking into this amazing data set about food culture.
So come on over. We've got the Flavor Network on our website. Like I said, it's kind of beautiful.
Next, we have a familiar flavor pairing, strawberries and rhubarb. But we're not making pie. This time, we're using this classic duo in a salsa. Yep, you heard me right. While you wait on the peppers and tomatoes to ripen, try this fresh fruity salsa from Chef Daniel Orr.
So, today, late spring, going into summertime, we still got some rhubarb out there, and it's the perfect time for salsa. Today, we're going to make a strawberry rhubarb salsa. Great with salmon, fatty fish, great with chicken, or you can just use it on your chips like a normal salsa. Now with rhubarb, you need to make sure you cut off the leaves. They are not edible for human beings. So cut those off and throw those in your compost. Next, we're going to dice that up. And I'm using this little tiny homegrown rhubarb from my mother's rhubarb patch. It makes it really easy because it's already pretty much cut up. And you can just dice it, and we're going to leave it raw. A lot of people don't think of eating rhubarb raw, but it's really sour. It's got that sweet tart kind of flavor to it. Throw those in our bowl. And then we're going to add some minced onions. Now, with salsas, you want pretty much everything cut the same size. And use that rhubarb as our guideline to how big we cut everything else. Next, we got some strawberries. You can get those real nice, sweet summer strawberries. And we'll do a couple more. Then we got some jalapeno. We're gonna add a little bit of tomato. But we want the rhubarb and the strawberry to be the stars in this performance. The Italians like to serve balsamic vinegar and a little cracked black pepper with their strawberries. So this isn't completely off the wall. I'm gonna mince up that about a half a jalapeno. And as with all chilies, the spiciest part is that white membrane that holds the seeds in the center of the pepper. So if you're really not into having a spicy dish, you can cut that white membrane off. I'm gonna add one tomato.
I spotted a few vendors with tomatoes already last week at the farmers market. But if they aren't ready in your area yet, you might want to use a handful of those nice, sweet cherry tomatoes you can find in the supermarket.
A few scallions to finish this off, as well as some cilantro. We have about four scallions, probably a quarter cup of chopped cilantro. Finish it off with the seasonings, pinch of garlic, couple tablespoons of extra virgin olive oil, juice, two limes, and then finally some salt and pepper. About a teaspoon of each. We'll put a little pinch of cayenne. Give that a toss. Just serve this over a little chicken breast. And that is our strawberry and rhubarb salsa with grilled free-range chicken breast.
We've got photos of this bright presentation plus the recipe at eartheats.org. We also have recipes for more traditional preparations of strawberry and rhubarb, eartheats.org. Production support comes from The Clean Bedroom, offering organic mattresses, adjustable beds, and pillows, helping mindful customers create a sustainable and organic clean bedroom, step by step. New York City, Boston, and now Indianapolis. More at thecleanbedroom.com. Charles Schwab & Company, Incorporated, with a local branch on Morton Street in Bloomington. Independent branch leader Jeremy Zeichner, CFP, offers personalized financial plans matched to investors' goals. More at schwab.com/Bloomington. Need more coffee roasters? A woman-owned coffee bar and roastery dedicated to roasting organic, direct trade, and fair trade coffee from small-scale farmers around the world. Offering signature drinks, teas, and little eats. Located on Pete Ellis Drive, needmoreroasters.com. That's it for our show this week. Thank you to all of the folks who make our show possible, including Aya Bonbinder, Chad Bouchard, Alex Chambers, Mark Chilla, Taylor Killo, Daniel Orr, and all the folks at Farm Bloomington Restaurant, the IU Food Institute, and Harvest Public Media. Special thanks this week to YY On, Maddie Chera, and Lee Bush. Earth Eats theme music is composed by Aaron Toby and performed by Aaron and Matt Toby. Our executive producer is John Bailey. I'm Kate Young. Thanks for listening to Earth Eats, and we'll see you next week.